You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jennifer Gilmore's latest novel, Something Red, opens with a farewell dinner that Dennis and Sharon Goldstein are giving for their son, Ben, who's leaving the following day to attend Brandeis University outside Boston. Ben has chosen Brandeis, whose alumni include Abby Hoffman and Angela Davis, hoping the school will help him follow his grandfather's edict to live his life taking chances and to commit himself to his hopes and dreams. But figuring out which of his dreams are meaningful proves a bit challenging for Ben and for his parents and Vanessa, the younger sister he's left behind. Jennifer Gilmore's book is published by Scribner. I'm very pleased that it brings her back to our show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. So nice to see you.
You were here 4 years ago to talk about your first novel, Golden Country, and before that you even worked on the show as a producer. Are you getting used to sitting on that side of the desk?
I like it on this side of the desk, and you have very fancy new digs, which are lovely to be in too.
Your first novel focused on three multi-generational immigrant families, and in this novel you also look at a multi-generational family that includes immigrants. Have you always been interested in what it means to be an immigrant?
I think I've been more interested in the way history affects families and what happens over time. So you have to deal with several generations. So a lot of my characters in the first book weren't from here, and I wanted to deal more in the second book. There are a few who weren't born here, but what happens once you've been in this country for a generation or two and sort of suffered from the psychic spoils of the first generation's efforts.
Mm. And the grandparents here are first generation.
Yes. Well, yes, most of them are. And they their experience, of course, is very different than the next generation. And Benji, who you mentioned, his grandfather was a Lower East Side communist, socialist. Well, he was a socialist, sorry, not a communist. And then the next generation, his son decides to work in the government for the civil service and believes that serving, that's a form of radicalism. And then Ben goes on to find his own special form as well. So everyone's looking for a way to express dissent, and sometimes that's through music, and sometimes that's through protest, but it changes and in some ways is dissipates over the generations.
Well, in this case, we're talking about a novel set in 1979, 1980, a time we don't normally think of as in a time of protest. Protest immediately conjures up the 60s into about maybe 75.
Absolutely. I mean, it's
the Vietnam War.
Part of why I chose that was 79, there was the hangover from the 60s. And that was sort of haunted also by the 20s and the 30s. But it was 1979, there was also Carter was president and there was a grain embargo. And I know when I told my editor, I'm going to write a book about the grain embargo, she was thrilled, and Jimmy Carter. But really, I wanted to deal with the way food plays out in the family and food plays out in the world. And that was sort of the perfect moment. And then I wrote my way into the Soviet Union and the Cold War and all these things I really had to bone up on.
And then, of course, the 53 Americans taken hostage in Iran.
Yes.
Something that still resonates today.
Absolutely. I mean, I found that a lot of what I was doing, looking at then resonated today. Obviously, what's going on in Afghanistan now is a little different, but it's a direct result.
And you mentioned food. You allude to all sorts of trends that were just starting then but are common now, like cooking with organic and local foods.
Yes. The mother is a caterer. She's obsessed with wheat germ, which I have, from my interviews, have found is back again. I didn't know that. But she's obsessively cooking and in a way and already starting to question this idea of soy and what is it. But it's not coming across to her daughter as mothering. It's more like her job. And it's an obsession that doesn't serve the family that well.
You've said that it's less confining to set a story in the past than in the present. What do you mean by that?
I think that once I figured out that an inner life is timeless, I found my grandmother's diaries, and in it, in addition to her getting her hair finger waved and all this kind of thing, she would always have a star where when she saw the man who would be my grandfather, and then one day she had three stars in her diary. And I don't know what that meant, but I realized that
I can guess.
I know, stop. That could be any girl's diary. So I realized I could set it any time. You know, mothers and daughters have had problems in the 20s, 30s, and, you know, from biblical times, I imagine. So it was freeing because I could do all sorts of research into the time period and then still have an intimacy with characters that you don't always get from sort of traditional historical fiction.
Well, the family patriarch is Sigmund, who's been living in a third-story walk-up apartment on Orchard Street on the Lower East Side with his wife, Tatiana, for some 40 or 50 years. the kind of apartment that you might see if you go to the Tenement Museum?
Yes, or you might be lucky to live in an apartment like that now. But yeah, and he's very happy there.
Well, this is before the hipsters moved in.
Yeah, it was before the hipsters, but it was after the Zionists and the anarchists. And, you know, he talks about how all these different kinds of people have come in through there. And he's very happy living there. He wants no more or no less than anyone else. All his friends have moved away. A lot of them became neocons. And he's happy where he is.
Well, he also has rent control.
Yeah, he has rent control. He does mention that.
He's slightly disdainful of the comfortable house that his son Dennis buys just outside of Washington, D.C. But Dennis keeps on insisting that his family lives in the city rather than in the suburbs because he doesn't want to disappoint his father.
Well, also, I mean, I grew up in Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is literally one moment away from D.C. And, you know, there are things on Facebook now. You can say you're from D.C., but you're not from D.C., this group and that group. It's a tension. What constitutes the suburbs? And so he's always insisting he doesn't live in the suburbs partially because his father has such disdain for it. And part of his disdain is that urban life is where he believes, you know, authentic life is lived.
Well, in the case of Washington, it's partly true that if you live in Bethesda or Chevy Chase, you are kind of living in Washington because it's all part of a metropolis in a way that living in Yonkers doesn't necessarily make you a part of New York City.
Well, we like to think that. It's all separated by Chevy Chase Circle. But also, I mean, what I want...
And cabs take you to the city line, and then you have to take another cab inside Washington.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't take cabs that much there. But that's funny. But it is this idea of what makes you an authentic person that these characters are all grappling with. And also, I wanted to set it in Washington, partially because I grew up there, but that tension between being so close to the mechanisms of power. You know, we were friends with lobbyists' kids and senators' kids. We got private tours of the White House. We went into the Oval Office. But we're as far and distant from that power as anyone else. And that tension, I really wanted to capture in how they lived.
Well, Dennis is working for the Department of Agriculture, but he believes that if he had been born just a few years earlier, he could have had a more interesting life, maybe even have joined a radical movement in the 1960s.
He questions whether or not he would have been someone who invited women and their dogs to sleep on a soiled mattress on the floor in San Francisco, but at the same time, he longs for that. Everybody in this book feels they've missed the exact time of protest. You know, Sigmund believes he missed the Bolshevik Revolution. Benji missed Woodstock, and Dennis missed, you know, San Francisco in the summer of love.
My guest is Jennifer Gilmore, whose novel Something Red is being published by, who's publishing this?
Scribner,
and it's gotten wonderful reviews.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Sharon, Dennis's wife, who you mentioned earlier, doing the catering, she also joins a cult-like group called LEAP, which I'm assuming is kind of like EST?
Kind of like EST, kind of like LifeSpring. I don't know if you heard of LifeSpring.
Well, that grew out of EST.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that was what the next thing that happened after the kinds of communal thinking of the 60s died out.
And led to what we now see as sort of a self-help. Her son leaves, she's devastated, and she can't decide between going back to Temple or going to this organization, and she chooses going to the organization and she questions it, and she meets someone there and has her own separate experiences. But it is a choice that she makes, and it's a choice a lot of people made in that time period.
Well, she is a caterer, and her daughter Vanessa has become bulimic.
Mm-hmm. It's a word I don't use because I don't think it was really used that much in 1979. But Vanessa is in the throes of adolescence, and she's decided she wants to try out punk rock and that she's in the straight edge movement. And she's using food like everyone uses food to control her body and control her adolescence in some way. And of course, we can't and she can't. And it does bloom out of control.
The novel moves back and forth in time between current events and events the characters remember from their past. Sometimes you write about the same event as remembered by different family members. Did including those memories allow you to explore the ways in which the actions of some members of the family had influenced the other members?
Absolutely. I am very interested as a concept in the way the past sits with us all the time. So,
and different people remember it.
Absolutely. We're having a conversation now, but I'm remembering seeing you, you know.
When I had dark hair.
Yeah,
I
long
wasn't all
hair
white.
And flowers in them. No. But so we are haunted in some ways by our memories, in good ways and bad ways. And so I for me, that very much informed who these characters were. So Dennis remembering going trick-or-treating with his daughter and this very positive experience is cut by his daughter having a horrible experience of wearing a mask that he made that she couldn't see out of and feeling very alienated.
It also allows you to break out of the time period. The book takes place over 7 months. But it also takes place over many years.
Absolutely. With this book, I thought, the last book took place over 40 years. I thought, this is going to take place over 7 months. And then, of course, it doesn't. It takes place over many, many years, even though it's in our memories.
The only one we haven't talked about is Ben. He's disappointed when he arrives at Brandeis to find that almost all of his classmates seem to be from New Jersey and there's not much going on by way of protest rallies.
Right. He finds his own protest. He's a jock in high school, and he sheds that skin, falls in love with a big-breasted radical woman, and she teaches him what it means to protest in a real way. It's skewering it and it's celebrating it.
But he also signs up for a year-long class on protest movements. Were there really classes like that?
I took a class called the 60s. I won't say who the professor was. He's still there. And
but this is obviously based on him.
Yeah, well, maybe. But it was a really interesting class. But you did have this profound feeling that everything had already happened. And Brandeis has such a new campus. There's no ivy on the walls and ivy on the buildings. And you have the sense that you can forge history there. But, of course, everything had already happened. And Ben's grappling with that a lot when he finds this protest of boycotting the boycott of the Olympic, of the Moscow Olympics that Carter calls.
Well, it's not as big an issue as the war in Vietnam.
No, it isn't. It isn't at all.
There's a surprise ending, which I won't reveal.
Please don't.
Did you know that it was going to end that way all along?
No, I didn't. I knew that I wanted to end it in a way that all the characters were really going to have to think about what it means to be a radical in a true way, as opposed to all these sort of little things that they're doing, and that it was going to be called into question in some way. And I also wanted to deal in a very real and authentic way with the Soviet Union. A lot of the immigrants were from what was then the Soviet Union or Russia, and then they were here, and I wanted to deal with that contrast and that conflict.
Although, ironically, only a few years later, there wasn't a Soviet Union.
Precisely. And then it all went away.
Right. And the world is great.
And,
right?
And everything heated up. And we have, and the Soviet Union. Yeah, exactly.
You told me that your first novel took you more than 6 years
Did
to
I tell
write.
You that?
Yeah. Well, when you were here last.
Right, right.
I'm assuming this one went a little quicker.
Well, it did, but I was working in publishing when I was writing that first novel, and I had
you were the publicist at Harcourt.
I was the publicity director at Harcourt, yes, and I eventually was left that job and wrote full time for 2 years or so. So I did have a lot more time to spend on the book. So now I teach, and that time is less. But it maybe took me 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems I can't write much faster than that.
Is this because you go through many drafts?
I'm someone who writes a ton, and then I have to carve it out and pull back. I also do a lot of research for this. Everybody is in some way haunted by the Rosenberg's execution. I read a lot about that. My generation doesn't know that much about it. I read biographies of Ethel Rosenberg, which were fascinating. I read about espionage. I read about the Cold War.
So writing a novel is really a matter of self-educating at the same time.
But the problem is when you write a novel, once it goes in the novel, you just forget everything.
Are you researching another book?
I'm trying a little bit here and there.
Meanwhile, you have this one, which, as I said, has been getting wonderful reviews. Something Red, Jennifer Gilmore's latest. It is published by Scribner. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again. It's great to see you.
Oh,
and I'm so proud of you.
Thank you, Leonard. It's so wonderful to be here.